Okay, good afternoon. So next Monday I'll be departing on a 9-day visit to Mexico, Colombia, Chile and Brazil. I'll lead a business delegation on this visit as part of the government's increased focus on strengthening bilateral relations and capitalising on trade opportunities with these Latin American countries. Latin America is one of the fastest growing and most dynamic regions in the world. Brazil and Mexico are now the 7th and 14th largest economies in the world respectively, and of course growing. Colombia has undergone huge economic change in the past decade or so and is now projected to grow between 4 and 6% a year for the foreseeable future. In the case of Chile, we have one of our closest and most long-standing relationships in Latin America. Combined GDP for the four countries is forecast to grow at just about 4% for the next few years. The countries have a combined population of 372 million and a combined GDP of around about $4 trillion. These are countries where New Zealand's skills and expertise in areas like agribusiness, renewable energy and education are of course a natural fit. They are also markets which present valuable opportunities for New Zealand businesses looking to export their services and expand their operations. The four countries, like New Zealand, are big producers of the food for the rest of the world and that the rest of the world wants, particularly beef and dairy products. There is a lot of scope for greater collaboration between our countries as we focus on meeting the global demands for reliable, efficiently produced foods and beverages. I'll be meeting President Enrique Peña Nieto in Mexico, President Juan Manuel Santos in Colombia, President Sebastian Piñera in Chile, and President Dilma Rousseff in Brazil. And I'm looking forward to discussing and enhancing our cooperation across a number of areas in education, trade, and as business investment partners. With the Presidents Peña Nieto and Piñera, I also plan to discuss the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations and our ambitions to conclude a comprehensive high-quality agreement by October of this year. Mexico, along with Canada, joined TPP negotiations late last year, and the inclusion of both the United States and NAFTA partners lends considerable economic weight to what has already been an impressive group of countries. I'll be returning to New Zealand on Thursday, the 14th of March. In terms of House activity this week, in the House, the government will progress the Child Support Amendment Bill, the Environment Canterbury, Temporary Commissioners and Improved Water Management Amendment Bill and the Corrections Amendment Act. Amendment Bill, should I say. In terms of ministerial activities, I'll be attending a dinner for the King of Tonga tonight and tomorrow, and Wednesday I'll be in Wellington for caucus and question time, on Thursday I'll be in Auckland, on Friday I'll be in Queenstown, and over the weekend I'll be at the PGA in Queenstown, and on Thursday should look out for the release of the discussion documents for the RMA.
Prime Minister, what do you make of the Labour Party's
Well, I think it's a sign of quite a divided caucus. I mean, in the end, he's had to work his way around a team that's not fully behind him as leader. He's had to manage those sensitivities, and that's really what you get at the other end.
What do you make of the axing of Trevor Mallard?
Well, not too bothered.
Do you think he'd make a good speaker?
Not really.
They brought Annie King up into an area that could be a bit of a challenge. Are you afraid that she's back on the front bench?
No, I mean, look, I'm very confident of our team. I think you can see that they've got the bit between their teeth this year. We've got a big agenda in front of us. You know, we always take our work very seriously, and we take our opponents seriously. So, you know, we don't take things for granted. But I'm confident my ministers are on top of the job and, you know, will equip themselves well in Parliament.
Annette King says Tony Ryle has created a climate of fear within the health sector, and that people are too scared to speak out. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's the complete opposite. I mean, Tony's done an outstanding job in health. If you think about it, we're spending about half the increase in new money that the previous Labor government used to spend. So we're spending about $350 million a year extra in health. Labor was spending about $750 per million a year extra in health, and yet we're achieving far better results. So 30,000 additional elective surgical operations undertaken in the last 4 years. Many more doctors and nurses have been hired. Most of the DHBs are now on top of their deficits. And you've got a health system that's performing extremely well. So in my view, health's been one of the real success stories for National over the last 4 or so years, and I'm very confident in Tony's capacity to do a good job in the future.
Are you comfortable with the HBG people within the health sector speaking out, though?
Sure, I mean, and you see that, and people do speak out. But on the other side of the coin, they speak out if they've got reason to speak out. And in most cases, actually, I think Tony's been running a very tight ship. He talks a lot to the DHB heads. He is on top of his portfolio. He's responsive where required. And I think you've seen him run some very, very good programs. I mean, just things like rheumatic fever have been a good example of where we've been reaching out, doing more in that space. So, look, I think, as I say, I'm very proud of what we've achieved in health.
The suggestion seems to be that that providers will miss out on funding, or this is why they're worried about speaking.
Well, I don't think that's true, and I don't think there's any evidence to support that.
So if people do have issues, you're welcome them to come and speak out?
Well, they're doing every other area. I can't see why they wouldn't in health.
Well, we don't seem to see it as much in health.
Well, I think that's because it's a reflection of the fact we're doing a very good job.
David Shearer has placed a big priority on arts and culture by having two aspirational inside the top four. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we have Chris Finlayson. I'd rather have our Chris Finlayson over there too, any day. And I think, again, National's got a good record in the arts. I mean, it's often Labor that will tout that they are very successful and that somehow they care and we don't. Actually, it's not true. We've either maintained funding and in some areas increased funding. Chris has certainly increased, I think, the efficiency in the arts sector as he's undertaken some reforms. I'm very confident we were going in a cash-strapped environment.
What do you think this shadow cabinet of Labor's would be like in government?
Well, that's for New Zealand voters to determine. But you've got to remember, of course, it would be laced heavily with Green members. And so this wouldn't be what a cabinet would look like. And the New Zealanders would have to consider whether they want to have those Green MPs as Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Finance and various other portfolios.
David Clark seems to think that Stephen Joyce has got a soft underbelly. And that he hasn't followed through on the economic plan. We haven't seen jobs, we haven't seen any sort of strong growth.
Well, in the end, I mean, Stephen Joyce has been a minister now for 4 and a bit years. He's the only person I can think of other than Margaret Wilson that's come straight into cabinet as a new MP. He's been hugely successful. And largely the opposition spend their time telling us that he's the minister of everything and capable of handling everything. So if David Clark's got a different view to the rest of their caucus team, fair enough. But I'm a person that likes to work in the evidence. And 4.5 years that Stephen's been a minister, he's proven he's an extremely competent one. And so, look, in the end, if David Clark wants to hone his guns on Stephen Joyce, well, luck to him.
But if the measure of the success is our economic growth rate and the ability of the New Zealand economy to grow at something 3% plus, you have to get it up to that.
Yeah, but you've got to be realistic. I mean, we've got a Minister of Economic Development, not a magician. I mean, we're dealing with a global financial crisis. What's happened in the earthquakes in Christchurch, generally a difficult trading position in lots of parts of the world and a high exchange rate. And on the back of all of that, we've got pretty good results. I'm not saying it's perfect, but we are growing when most countries aren't. Our situation in terms of returns are surplus and our deficits much smaller than most other countries who haven't had to deal with the likes of the Christchurch earthquake, etc., etc. So, I mean, I think we've done good reforms of the economy, undertaken good reforms in the economy over the last 4 years, and there's more to do. But we inherited a position from Labor where it was just simply not sustainable. If you go back and look at what the debt trap was going to be if we carried out Labor's policies and Labor's spending plans without the reforms that we've undertaken, then we would have had massive amounts of debt being accumulated in New Zealand. And we've got a much more efficient economy. Look at where we're going in things like the Freedom Index and the likes. If you think about the international environment and what's happening in terms of business confidence surveys and the likes, I think that's an indication, again, that people are confident that we're going in the right direction.
You
so you've got to be realistic.
Sure.
Look, we're in a situation now where Macquarie as the investment bank are basically undertaking a forensic analysis now of the situation as they understand it. We've also got a position where the banks, the government and other interested parties in the company are sitting around the table to work out what are the next steps. In the short term we're trying to stabilise the company, and in the long term we'll be trying to work out what the right model and approach for solar energy is.
What does it mean for Pike River?
In the short term, that's a very different issue because we've always known, or at least for some time, that solar energy's got some financial issues, so that I don't think that actually alters anything in the short term. I mean, there is a couple of things happening there at the moment. Firstly, they're trying to work up a proposal for whether a movement or an entry into the Drift is possible, and those meetings are being undertaken. We're also having a meeting of the experts from the families, along with the experts that were on the Royal Commission, the High Hazards Unit, and again Solar Energy's board, to one day look at, you know, whether re-entry into the overall mine is possible. My view is it's extremely unlikely in terms of the overall mine, but that's, they are different set of circumstances so I'm faced on the Drift.
Position on this?
In terms of the Drift re-entry, I have had one meeting in recent times. Again, it's very early days and that work hasn't been completed, but in theory at least, it would be possible to get up the Drift. There are other examples around the world where that's happened. In terms of entry into the main working of the mine, I haven't found anybody yet who's told me that that's possible or in their view that they believe would ever be possible. And it's a very difficult situation, I understand, for the families, but I think everyone has to appreciate that there's been huge structural damage in that mine, 3 or 4 major explosions, a very large fire, and a flood. So I think it's eminently possible you can get up the Drift. I think it's basically impossible to get in the workings of the mine.
When did you first become aware that Solid Energy was racking up big debts, given coal companies apparently don't generally take on huge debt, given that... ups and downs of the commodity side?
Yeah, so what happened was when we started to embark on the mixed ownership model as a policy, and we're advancing that further to satisfy ourselves that these companies could actually be brought to market, we did a scoping study on 4 of the SOEs. At the end of that scoping study in relation to Solid Energy, it was quite obvious that there were a number of issues. So the first thing was that the price path that the Solid Energy directors and management had for coal was at complete odds with the international projections for coal. So they were grossly overstating what they thought they would achieve for coal. That was the first issue. The second thing was the scoping study said essentially the alternative investments that had been made by Solid Energy were, in their view, basically either worthless or of very low value. The third thing that was shown up in the scoping study was that the level of proven reserves for coal were inadequate compared to a normal coal company. So right back in 2011, certainly by early 2012, we were starting to have considerable discussions with
so
the company.
So what had they been telling you between 2008 and 2011? Because have you been misled?
Well, it's not a matter of being misled. I think there's a couple of things. I mean, if you take a step all the way back, back in about 2007, Trevor Mallard was the Minister of SOE back in those times. And you'll recall he gave a speech that said SOE should really expand out and take that opportunity to grow new opportunities and new businesses. I think that was the starting point at which Solid Energy started to think about what could the structure of the company look like. So by early about 2009, when we first came in, they started to approach us to become what I think they termed a natural resources company, but certainly they wanted a very large capital injection in the order of about $1 billion to turn this company into the Petrobras equivalent in New Zealand. The government sought some advice on that and rejected the proposition. But of course, under the SOE Act, the company had the right to draw down debt and make investments. And it could do that without reference to the shareholder, and certainly drew down debt and certainly made those investments. Well, I don't think the approval wasn't required from us because they're free to make those decisions themselves. I mean, what is fair to say is that coal prices were a lot higher, government, you know, and the valuation of the company was much higher at that point, but those decisions were made by the board and management.
Is your advice to telling me that, no, don't give them $1 billion? Why weren't they also saying, don't let these guys borrow?
Well, I think there was a difference between what the company could fund off its, theoretically, its own balance sheet and where they wanted to go. And where they wanted to go, the government was not at all comfortable with in terms of where they were going with their own financing. We argue probably not as comfortable as the company was, but they were within their rights to do that and the company was had a pretty high valuation, and the coal price was pretty highly valued at that point. So there's a whole lot of different factors that have gone on there.
It seems that what you're saying is that at some point there was a string of bad management decisions.
Well, yes. I mean, you could say a few things. Firstly, they overvalued what they thought coal would be worth. Then they got that completely and utterly wrong. And we were in discussions with them for a long period of time about why we thought they were wrong. And right up until basically the middle part of, I think, of 2012, they still rejected the international view of where coal was likely to go. Secondly, they made a whole lot of investments of which they were proven to be basically worthless. So they invested a lot of money in areas that just simply didn't make a return. And as I said, the third problem was that they added gearing to a company that would historically not have gearing. Now, you know, it's also in fairness, and you know, I think if you look at other coal companies, BHP and Rio Tinto, they're also experiencing significant issues in their coal companies. It's just that those issues are more pronounced in the case of solid energy, because the other alternative investments, they may have been poor ones.
So the government have any idea? You're saying that you disapproved of what the SRE was doing, and you made that clear, but the SRE Act prevented you from intervening in any way.
No, what I'm saying is we didn't agree with the massive expansion of the company. We were aware that they were making investments, but they didn't require our approval to make those investments.
So there's nothing you could do to stop, even though you disapproved, there's nothing the government could do to stop that?
Well, what it shows you under the SOE Act is there's a lot of devolved authority. So yes, there are things, of course, you can do, and not the least in being you can sack the board, that's true. But of course, to sack the board, you'd have to have reason for that, and at that time, when they were making those investments, probably the debt levels were reasonably low, the valuation of the company was reasonably high, the price actually being achieved for coal was quite high, so it was a very different scenario.
Did you consider sacking them?
No, I don't think so. Not in
did the you did the government talk to the directors, the chairman, and make its things clear about that?
It certainly did around the natural resources company. So, you know, what is clear is they had the view of really changing the mix of solid energy. And effectively what you saw is they did that in a small baby steps way, funded off their own balance sheet, but their real aspirations were to make giant leaps into a multifaceted resource company.
Okay, and what about those subsequent moves into, which didn't require that amount of funding, but the less ambitious moves that you said they were able to finance?
So I can't tell you the exact discussions. I wasn't involved personally in those, so I can't tell you the exact discussions about what took place between the minister or ministers and their board. We would have been aware of it. We would have seen it like others have seen it. But I'm simply saying a lot of that responsibility is devolved down to the company.
Does there need to be some changes then to the SLE Act?
Well, I think it argues really strongly for why the mixed ownership model is right. So lots of New Zealanders have been fed the line by Labor that somehow these companies are better managed under the SOE Act. Actually, it's not true. If the mixed ownership model was in place, you would have had external directors, you would have had much greater external analysis, you would have had a share price that would have reflected the problems that the company was facing, and they would have had continuous disclosure under the NZX rules. None of those parts of the equation were there under the SOE Act. So the only way we really found how serious the problems were, the main way they were discovered, was when we did the scoping study on the back of one who did mixed ownership.
So how are you going to find out what problems might be in other SOEs that aren't going to be partially solved?
Well, Comu's responsibility is to do that. They theoretically have the oversight there in a way. But all I'm saying to you is that's why I like the mixed ownership model. Far from what some people will believe, that actually puts the government in a weaker position, my view is it actually puts the government in a stronger position.
The previous governments have restricted what SOEs can do. There's always been a tension about whether they... I mean, the whole point about the mixed ownership model really is to free up SOEs to be...
But in an environment where other shareholders have their money on the line, where there's external exposure, where there's continuous disclosure, where there is other external analysis. And that is the advantage, at least, of that model, is that it's much more likely to bring into the public domain both the risks and the opportunities.
Do you believe that those investments wouldn't have been made if it had been the mixed ownership model?
Well, all I can tell you is that when the scoping study was undertaken, the advisors came back to the government and to the company in, I think it's early 2012 by the time we did that, and said, your price pass for coal, we can't reconcile that with anything we see internationally. And for a long period of time, the board just refused to accept that their pricing for coal was wrong. Secondly, they came back and said, your level of proven coal reserves is way too low for a coal company. Again, they refused to accept that. So there's been lots and lots of different areas where the robustness of disclosure through a stock exchange listing would have put a lot greater spotlight on that company, in my opinion, would make the company be better run.
Is that a sufficient reason to remove the board, though?
Yep, so
I mean, your advisors are saying you're taking steps that are not prudent, and they're saying we don't accept that, we're going to go ahead.
Yep, so that was the start of some very robust discussions between ourselves and the company, or the Minister of SOEs and the company, and those robust discussions went on for a period of time. What it's fair to say is, late last year, was when the company, basically through the chairman, one day came to the government and said, we now agree with you. The price of coal is actually going to stay low for a long period of time, and therefore we need to close Spring Creek. And it was at that point we said, well, we just want to make sure we're absolutely right. There's obviously a change of chairman, largely a change of board, and that was when we started doing more analysis.
But given the contrast and the advice, yours and theirs, why didn't you act immediately? I mean, it's all very well having robust conversations, but this company is spiralling out of control.
Not really at that point. Those decisions had already been taken and made.
What decisions were taken and made?
Well, you're talking about a process that took place in the, I think, the middle part of 2011, roughly-ish, or end of it, when the scoping study began. The government, when it got that scoping study, started having extensive conversations with the company, but by then those decisions around investing in Spring Creek, investing in the wood pellet plant, investing in lignite, largely a lot of those decisions had been made.
So in hindsight, would you prefer to do the scoping study earlier?
Well, there's a lot of ifs, buts, and maybes, so you can always look at those things. As said, it has to be seen in the context of, in 2009 and 2010, when they were essentially executing their plan off their own balance sheet, the company's valuation was very high and coal prices were very high, so the position was quite different. But if you're looking at the way you would run a prudent long-term coal business, then certainly industry experts would tell you you're doing them to a different way to the way that their board executed that plan. And that is because the board's fundamental view was they didn't want Solid Energy just to be a good coal mining company, they wanted to be a very diversified natural resources company.
It sounds as if you're trying to wash your hands of the whole thing. What responsibility does the government have for this debate?
Well, it's not a matter of us washing our hands, it is the reality of the situation. Back in 2007, Labor then encouraged the SOEs to start thinking about diversifying. Those things started, and the board and management started on that path of wanting to do that. As I said to you, in 2009, they came to the government and asked for a big capital injection, and we said no. We started our forensic analysis with them in 2011, and that's been ongoing. So there are some things you just can't change. Coal prices were very high back then, and
they're going to be. 9/11, isn't it, where your responsibility seems to have been lacking? I mean, they came to you with drastic expansion plans, You said no, and they just went ahead and did them anyway.
No, but they're different. See, in 2009, what they wanted to expand and what they actually did do, they did some stuff, but not nearly what they wanted to do.
So did you tell them at any stage, I think you said they took baby steps.
Yep.
At any point did the government say you didn't want them to do that?
I can't answer that question. I don't know the answer to that.
But isn't it incumbent on the government to do that? I mean, you can't sit back and just let a company that's owned by the state go on willy-nilly and make decisions independent of the government.
Yeah, so back in 2000, in that early period, 2008-2009, the situation was quite different. So, the coal price was much higher. Yes, the company actually was quite profitable. And yes, its valuation was quite different. If you're taking a really prudent approach about the way to run a coal company, You would have completely narrowed what they did, but to do that you probably would have needed to change the SOE board back then. I mean, the government, by saying it didn't want to fund this vast natural resources company, at least gave an indication of where our level of comfort was.
Without that scoping study, how long would it have taken for the government to find out about
it? Well, I don't know if you answer that question, but longer.
What's your feeling on the performance of the previous chief executive, Dr.
Donald? Well, in the end, people will have to judge this for themselves. They can judge, he was there for a long period of time, as was John Palmer as chairman. And some things they got very right, and quite clearly some things they got very wrong.
So you saved $1 billion by refusing the expansion program, but I mean, in the end, how much is it going to cost the taxpayer?
Don't know.
No idea whatsoever.
No.
Do you think it has any value at the moment? Do you think it's worth more than what it owes?
I'd be surprised, as we stand here today. But again, you've got to remember that you're looking at it as a snapshot in time, which is on current coal prices, with $389 million worth of debt and a burn rate of some businesses that's still either divesting or winding up, I'd be surprised if it's got much of a current market value. But again, coal prices may over time improve. The debt situation will have to be looked at for the company. There's the nucleus of potentially quite a good business there, different to what it was in the past, but in isolation as we stand here today, not a lot.
Given that your government has encouraged active mining and exploration, you wanted more development, perhaps they felt they were just reading the signals.
No, I don't think that's right. I think what they took the view, and again, their view was that there were a lot of alternative investments that were profitable, and they'd worked on those for a very long period of time. Some of those well before the government, we became the government. So lignite conversion, for instance, and liquid syn gas and all the various other things they were working on, they've been working on for a long period of time. So these things aren't actually new, but what you've got to say is that despite making some fairly reasonably sized investments in alternative streams of revenue, they actually proved to be investments that were poorly executed. Well,
where does this leave the $5 to $7 billion you were hoping to get for these four energy companies?
Well, obviously solid energy isn't coming to the market anytime soon, but we always gave ourselves a window of 5 years, and in a way this is probably not new news, because if you go back and replay your post-cabinet press conferences, I distinctly remember discussions with one or two of you where I said, is one of those companies that's not looking so cheery at the moment. That's the one.
But is your 5 to 7 reviewed down 4 to 6?
Oh, look, at the moment, I think the more prudent thing to do would be wait for the Supreme Court's ruling this week, see what the next step is from here, and give it a little bit of time. You can't rule out that one day solid energy might be a company that can be taken to market on mixed ownership, but I think you can rule it out in the short term.
How much of the $5 to $7 billion was solid energy?
Don't know exactly.
It was 1.7 billion.
Well, it depends. I mean, the valuation that the government had and the valuation that the directors had were very, very different valuations.
As tourism minister, would you have any part in helping Nick Smith make his decision about the North of Darts Highway and the monorail?
Well, he has statutory responsibility now, effectively he's given himself that, to make that decision. So obviously he'll consult as he goes through his decision-making process as advisor to the Department of Conservation. So in so much that my ministry will probably feed into, a submission on the process, and has done so, I think, or at least has offered some views on it. Yes, but the final decision-making, I'm pretty sure, is Nick Smith's.
What should the people who are involved in that take from Nick Smith's decision to be the...
Well, I think he's taken the sensible step. I mean, in the end, of course we could have continued to have that decision-making responsibility devolved to the ministry and to others. But these are sort of political decisions for which the government will always be criticised, whether it makes the decision or not, or critiqued at least. So in the end, it's very hard to take the politics out of these decisions. They're quite big decisions, and I think it probably makes sense for the government just to step up and say, you know, through its minister, will make the decision that thinks is right.
It could be good for tourism.
I'm sorry, but we're going to have to wrap this up.
Sorry.
Could it be good for tourism?
Oh, look, there are arguments both sides, both ways. Yeah.
Did you overrule Heke Whangarei
for after all Whangarei Collegiate? No. I mean, in the end, I'll just take this and I've got to go because I'm sorry I've got something going to. But the long and short of it was, that was a very difficult decision. There were a range of views over quite a long period of time as we tried to stabilise Whangarei Collegiate. And I think at the end, you know, the view that was finally reached was on a line ball call, it was the right thing to integrate it. And that was really on the basis of, it's been a very high performing school, it's had a long standing history, the community support for it was very high in Whangarei, and it plays quite an important role in their community. And so in the end, we reached the call that was the right thing to do. I mean, that was the minister's decision in the end, and you know, I think she got it right.
Has the government made any decision on its response to the Waitangi Tribunal report on Kōhana?
No, not yet, I don't think so.